Good evening, folks, on this Saturday, the 11th of May, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Call. Welcome back, and let's talk for a while about what's going on, what's being lied about when it comes to what's going on. More importantly, let's try to connect some dots as well. And given how much of the news continues to have to do with invasion, war, and of course, treason on the home front, a lot of that, and a whole lot of people doubling down as they blame the innocent for their own crimes and the fact that they're now being revealed, let's start with what might be some good news on that front, and maybe even some better news to follow. No, certainly not as good as Hillary Clinton, or even Whoremeister himself, James Comey, in an orange jumpsuit, but there's no doubt that the information needed to get there has been confirmed. As promised, and we covered earlier in the week, award-winning investigative journalist, and I like using that term when it's apropos, John Solomon, has obtained and delivered memos from a high-ranking government official who met with none other than infamous British spy Christopher Steele in October of 2016, and in the process determined that Steele's so-called dirt on Trump was inaccurate and likely leaked to the media. All of this has to do with new memos and handwritten notes taken by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kathleen Kavalak on October the 11th of 2016, no less than 10 days before the first bogus FISA warrant on Trump campaign advisor Carter Page was granted by a court which was lied to, as we've now seen very clearly. And you know what, folks? If anybody else had done this, it would have actually been a crime. Recall, writes Christina Layla for the Gateway Pundit, the FBI swore, for what that's worth, to the FISA judge that Christopher Steele's, quote, reporting has been corroborated and used in criminal proceedings. Well, it certainly should be now one of these days, shouldn't it? And the FBI determined him to be, get this, reliable, and I guess by their standards, when you consider the likes of McCabe, Strzok, Page, and of course Comey himself, maybe they weren't kidding. And furthermore, that they were unaware of any derogatory information pertaining to their so-called confidential human source, who, as it turns out, was also working for Fusion GPS, the opposition research firm paid for by Hillary Clinton and Perkins Coie, to do exactly what we now know they did. One of the red flags from Kavalak's memos included a claim that Steele said payments to those recruited by the Russians to target the election were made out of the Russian consulate in Miami. There's only one problem, though, noted Kavalak in her bracketed comments. Quote, it's important to note that there is no Russian consulate in Miami. So what did Kathleen Kavalak do with all that information? 2 days later, and well before the bogus FISA warrant was issued, she forwarded her typed summary to other government officials. And guess what the State Department did? Yeah, they redacted the names and agencies of everyone that she alerted. Furthermore, notes the story, it's almost certain the FBI knew, or we would say should have known, of Steele's contact with the Department of State and his partisan motive. That's because former Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland says she instructed her staff to send the information they got from Steele to the Bureau immediately and to cease contact with the informer because, quote, listen to this, this is about U.S. politics and not the work of, not the business of the State Department, and certainly not the business of a career employee who is subject to the Hatch Act, unquote. So see, folks, there were some people who actually tried to blow the whistle, but not only did nobody that mattered hear it, but those who did covered it up. And the answer to the why of all of that is obvious, because had the FBI acknowledged Kavalak's memos, they would have been forced to disclose that information, well, if they were honest, and we know that isn't an issue, to the FISA judges. And what does that do to your insurance policy? There's lots more, of course, but by now the pattern is clear, and all of it points in the very same direction. The question, of course, remains, do we still have a rule of law or not? And on that score, this quick story fits here, very much related. Fox News legal expert and author Greg Jarrett joined Sean Hannity Thursday night to discuss the recent remarks by one of the Capos de Tutte criminals at the FBI, former Whoremeister himself and FBI chief, on about the second anniversary of his firing, James Comey. referring to the fact that Crooked Comey keeps doubling down and lying even more through his teeth to cover his tracks, and the latest bombshell releases from John Solomon, Jarrett said the following.
John's documentary evidence now proves conclusively that James Comey was lying to a FISA court, and of course tonight on CNN you played the clip when he said he went by
fake
the
news.
Book. That's also a lie to the American public. You know, James Comey is now swinging these wild haymakers because he knows that very soon he's going down on the canvas for a 10 count. He is in deep, serious legal jeopardy
Greg,
for a number of things.
Greg.
Lying to a FISA court. Leaking government documents that he stole, starting an investigation without credible evidence, spying on the Trump campaign, and making false statements to Congress. I hope he saved all of the money he made from that phony book of his talking about liars and lying people, because he's going to need the money for his defense team.
Well, let's pray that that's true, because history has certainly shown us that the alternative is really, really ugly. If we have time later on, we'll get back to some of the unraveling of the greatest act of documented treason in U.S. history. There have been others, of course, probably by a lot of the same people that have not yet come out, but who knows? It's possible they might. We've certainly seen indications of them. Maybe the communist Chinese will eventually let it slip by naming some of them heroes of the fatherland. Meanwhile, though, the good news is simply that the information is coming out, and those who are lying through their teeth and committing further acts of cover-up, and yes, high crimes, misdemeanors, and outright treason, are already without excuse, and more Americans are realizing that. From there, one more bit of good news, really good news as a matter of fact, but we need to set it up first with the really bad news that preceded it. The idiocy in the public cesspools, along with the gun-free killing zone murders that go with it. From Chris Menahan at Information Liberation, as well as the much-banned, maligned, and censored Alex Jones' sites like Prison Planet and InfoWars, and also a news site called Heavy.com. In the most recent gun-free killing zone attempted mass murder and massacre, it turns out that those who ignored the law, including notably, Thou Shalt Not Murder, were far-left Trump-hating atheist progressives. Who could have thought it? And that, says Menahan, is why you can be certain that the latest school shooting in Colorado, after it served its false flag, let's ban all the guns now purposes, will be dropped by the media real quick. And more about this story seems to underscore that point. So stay with me. Now, folks, let me make this point clear up front. The fact that a couple of Bible-hating leftists tried to kill a bunch of people in Highlands Ranch, Colorado at the STEM school is anecdotal evidence and actually proves nothing, at least so far as their race, gender, ethnicity, or politics is concerned. But it certainly is educational to observe the media spin. Let's just say, for starters, I bet on a lot less MSNBC and CNN coverage of their Facebook postings. And as for what prescription drugs they're taking, for what mental conditions they may be dealing with, be it the mass murder-connected SSRI drugs or whatever, well, we've already gotten used to seeing nothing, nothing, nothing reported on that score. Because one thing's for sure, the mass media certainly doesn't have a prescription drug control agenda. Because guess who's paying their bills? From the stories, Devin Erickson, an 18-year-old high school student who's worked as a youth actor in Colorado, was identified by authorities as one of the two shooters accused of killing one and wounding eight students in a K-12 STEM school located in Douglas County. And in court for the first time on Wednesday, May 8th, the purple-haired Erickson bowed his head, facing more than two dozen charges, for the most part answering the judge's questions by shaking his head. The second shooter has now been identified as Alec McKinney, but is identified in court records as Maya McKinney. A Denver TV station reports that McKinney is transgender, transitioning to male, and prefers to be addressed by the pronoun he. On socialist media, Erickson, a registered Democrat, expressed hatred for Christians and shared posts criticizing Donald Trump and praising the sainted bathhouse Barry Obama. There were also pictures online of his car as it was towed from the shooting suspect's home, sporting the words F Society spray-painted on one side with what looks like 666 and a pentagram on the hood. And in one of his, at least temporarily going viral, socialist media posts, Erickson wrote, quote, "You know what I hate? All these Christians who hate gays, yet in the Bible it says in Deuteronomy 17:12-13, if someone doesn't do what their priest tells them to do, they're supposed to die. It has plenty of crazy stuff like that, but all they get out of it is, ooh, gays," unquote. And again, folks, the main thing that all of this proves is that, well, watch the actions of the waste stream and see what it is they're not going to leap all over as an indication. And one other trend that your host has been watching now for quite a while, the obvious false flags do tend to have a clearly political agenda associated with them. In hindsight, it's incredibly obvious. This one seems to be a bit different now, doesn't it? And if nothing else, I'm going to be looking for suggestions over time, probably not covered by the waste stream, of course, that all the false flags and manipulation of public opinion may finally be starting to have the desired effects, at least so far as the deep state is concerned, of kicking off the intended bloodletting in mass. And they'll get some traction among those looking to kill more and more people as Civil War 2.0 goes into high gear. But wait, you're probably thinking, where's that good news you promised? Well, here we go, courtesy of Breitbart. At what was billed as a vigil for Kendrick Castillo, the brave 18-year-old young man who was killed, evidently trying to rush the shooters on Tuesday, a whole lot of students at that school showed that there really is hope, because not all of them have been dumbed down as much as the waste stream would like. Local media and the Federalist and, of course, Breitbart are all reporting that perhaps hundreds of students walked out of that so-called vigil when prominent speakers like Democrat Senator Michael Bennett and Representative Jason Crow of Colorado each took their turns calling for more discredited gun control in an already gun-free killing zone, prompting what even USA Today admitted was hundreds of students from the STEM school to storm out in protest, yelling things like, "This is not for us, political stunt," and "We are people, not a statement." The NRA statement pointed to a far more important and obviously overlooked cause, because, hey, you know one thing's for sure, they're not going to tell you what these nutcases were on, especially if it was SSRIs or other drugs. But no doubt the indications are there. They said, the day after a heroic student gave his life to save others, anti-gunners politicized the event by hosting a rally misleadingly labeled as a vigil, and upset the students left the rally, among other things, chanting mental health, and demanded that they not be used as political pawns. And I'd say that's plenty of good news, but I do appreciate the fact that Breitbart spoke to Andrew Pollack, father of Parkland school victim Meadow Pollack, who was asked what he thought of the students' decision to march out once the vigil turned into a gun control rally. And his response, it bears repeating, quote, "I praise good parenting," unquote. And yeah, folks, you gotta love it. So let's wrap up some of the rest of the week's news, starting with a series of updates. The first one I'll call the invasion update. I've got several stories along the same lines. From Breitbart, we've heard this before, we're going to keep hearing it until Big Brother quits encouraging the invasion to continue. DHS catch and release figures over the last 6 days, for which there's a record, 7,400 or so. That's continuing to average about 1,200 a day. And remember, folks, those are just the ones that get caught and dispersed. Even NPR admits that April is now the second month in a row with over 100,000 invaders, 109,144 officially, and that's an increase of over 5%, or about 5,400, over the March record. But perhaps even more alarmingly, over 1% of the entire populations of both Guatemala and Honduras have entered the United States since last September, according to acting Homeland Security Chief Kevin K. McAleenan, who added that that figure includes 3% of one county in Guatemala alone. Speaking at the 49th Washington Conference on the Americas, McAleenan said that the current migration flows represent, quote, both a security and humanitarian crisis, noting that the situation is, and I'd say obviously, not sustainable. He continued by adding that the trends are deepening and accelerating, noting that according to a recent USAID-funded study earlier this year, 1 in 4 Guatemalans intend to emigrate from that country, with 85% of them planning on coming to the People's Republic of Norte Americana as their preferred destination. And that's over 4 million people, or you could think of it as about 5 San Franciscos. Yes, with the obvious implications intended. Here's where, in your host's opinion, the acting DHS secretary dropped the ball, explaining that the U.S. economy is a lure for illegal immigrants and poor economic conditions at home are a push. He added that Washington shares the blame. Get this, quote, "The main cause of the current increases is the weakness in the U.S. immigration system, the vulnerabilities of our legal framework, which allow migrants, especially families and unaccompanied children, even slave children, I note, or as we've talked about recently, rent a kiddie pass, to stay in the U.S. for months or years, even though the vast majority," said McElhinney, "will not ultimately receive legal status." Here's what isn't being stated, folks, although it ought to be. The vast majority will, however, suck at the public teat and get all kinds of wonderful freebies, which will bring more and more just like them, looking for the same goodies. And these are the kind of facts that those who prattle mindlessly about this nation's history of immigrants would just as soon you didn't know. People used to come here yearning to breathe free, to work hard and build a better life for their children. Yes, to learn the language and assimilate. In other words, to adopt the shared values that once upon a time were those things that made America, America, like the belief in God-given rights and free enterprise, as opposed to just free stuff. And no, they didn't get all kinds of freebies when they came in, legally or not, even though the vast majority did try to come in legally. Oh, and when they came through Ellis Island, they also were screened for diseases, unlike the masses of migrants coming north now, carrying, well, basically God alone knows what, but we're beginning to find out. And no doubt all of that will be a great excuse for forcing you to take an involuntary vaccination too, which is perhaps part of the bigger equation and plan anyway. Oh, and before we move on, one more quick quote, courtesy of the NPR story, ironically from the chief of Border Patrol, Carla Provost, who told a Senate Judiciary panel that, quote, "Our apprehension numbers are off the charts." And she continued, "We cannot address this crisis by shifting more resources. It's like holding a bucket under a faucet. Doesn't matter how many buckets you give me if we can't turn off the flow," unquote. Maybe she should have said, "Refuse to turn off the flow." This next one would almost be funny if it wasn't so hypocritically asinine and demonstrative of just how far down the toilet bowl the U.S. Congress has already swirled. Dateline Washington, AP. The House Judiciary, sick, committee voted on Wednesday to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for reasons that they don't really think they have to explain. But the Associated Press called it an escalation of the Democrats' extraordinary legal battle with the Trump administration over access to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's unredacted Trump-Russia report. Note that they aren't the least upset about all the other things that the Justice Department stonewalled for year after year concerning stuff that didn't show up in the Mueller report anyway. And for the first time ever, they note, literally breaking with tradition from the all-powerful executive branch, President Donald Trump has now finally invoked the principle of executive privilege. Maybe he's had enough, blocking lawmakers, sick, from seeing what the law said, things like grand jury redactions that weren't supposed to be leaked anyway. Committee Chief Buffoon Jerry Nadler of New York made a whole bunch of idiotic declarations, including that the president is doing a blanket defiance of Congress's constitutional right to conduct oversight, saying that the so-called blockade is, quote, "an attack on the ability of the American people to know what the executive branch is doing," unquote. And this cannot be. Well, folks, it has been, and ironically, it certainly has been under his watch for year after year after year now, because it's pretty darn obvious what's changed. Justice Department spokeswoman Carrie Kupek said it was disappointing that members of Congress have, quote, "chosen to engage in such inappropriate political theatrics," unquote. At least that's a humorous understatement. She pointed out that Barr made extraordinary efforts to provide Congress and the public with information about Mueller's so-called work. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said neither the White House nor Barr will, quote, "comply with Chairman Nadler's unlawful and reckless demands." He didn't, of course, and by Friday he was joking about it, saying, "This must be some kind of record for an attorney general being proposed for contempt within 100 days of taking office." And I'll say it again. Since Congress seems to hold the Constitution in such contempt, it's fitting for the attorney general and all the rest of us to hold them in contempt, too. Adam Schiffless of California, true to form, threatened legal action. And if he actually paid attention to the law, that in itself would be a notable first. The AP does admit that while the White House, up until now, has exercised remarkable restraint, breaking with all previous administrations when it came to invoking executive privilege, Trump told his staff and political advisors over recent weeks to refuse to cooperate with the witch hunt now in the House, believing the Democrats' goal was simply to damage him politically going into his re-election campaign. Gee, do you think? And here I do have to interject, I think there's a bit of restraint on his part there as well. They're covering up for a whole lot of outright criminal activity to boot. From Comey, the lynch mob, and Hitlery, to Mueller. Other Democrats, demonstrating again their utter ignorance of the Constitution, referred to the need to protect our democracy, not to be confused, of course, with the Constitutional Republic. But when it comes to brainless rhetoric, folks, it's tough to top this one from Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas. Quote, "The president now seeks to take a wrecking ball to the Constitution of the United States."
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So, from the war on what's left of the Constitution, and they've been pretty effective with that wrecking ball for long enough that I'd have to say not much, we do go to an update on the other wars. And in no specific order, North Korea has launched their second ballistic missile in less than a week. South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff confirmed the North appears to have fired two short-range ballistic missiles as of 4:29 and 4:49 p.m. local time there, flying between about 150 and 300 miles. Says Zero Hedge, what with trade war tensions between Washington and Beijing at a breaking point, we can't help but wonder if Kim got the tap from his Chinese benefactors, who could benefit greatly from this particular latest distraction, as if there weren't a whole bunch of others out there on the table already. Further east, kind of Midland or so, Tehran tried to call Washington's bluff again on Wednesday when it threatened to start stockpiling enriched uranium and heavy water all over again. That would constitute a violation of the JCPOA's terms unless everybody abides by their commitments to buy their oil and offer other financial goodies, something that American sanctions have rendered impossible. But in what is said to be an attempt to show Tehran who's boss and that it's not bluffing, Washington has committed another threatening display of force by sending the USS Abraham Lincoln and its associated strike group, which had been dispatched to the Mediterranean last week, through the Suez Canal, the first stop in what appears to be a journey into Iranian waters. And perhaps even unchartered waters as well. Closer to home, at least when it comes to the botched war down in Venezuela, Trump says a piece summarized by Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge has turned on Bolton and accused him of, quote, trying to start a war in Venezuela. And here, of all things, they're quoting the WAPO. Shortly before President Trump, it begins, tweeted about a meeting with Marco Rubio and Rick Scott where the, quote, terrible abuses by Maduro were discussed. The WAPO published an anonymously sourced story claiming that Trump is growing frustrated with the situation in Venezuela, and he's blaming aides like Bolton for misleading him about the chances of success of opposition leader and president, not really, Juan Guaido. Privately, says the WAPO, Trump has described Maduro as a tough cookie, and he's blamed aides for misleading him when they said that the socialist strongman could be ousted during last week's demonstrations. Gee, makes you wonder what happened to words like revolution or coup. And over recent days, he's expressed instead concern that Bolton is trying to get him, quote, into a war. And perhaps the leaked plan for U.S.-backed coup prepared by Southcom hasn't helped to assuage those concerns either. Remember, notes the summary from Zero Hedge, Bolton has been a key figure in escalating tensions with Iran as well, in what's starting to look like the brink of an armed conflict. And although the WAPO insists that Bolton's job is safe, well, at least for now, the fact that Trump has finally, at long last, caught on to the drawbacks of Bolton's neoconishness and now appears to understand that Bolton's views are at odds with the ones he has publicly expressed, especially when he was running for president, none of that bodes well for his prospects. Which may, however, bode at least a bit better for the rest of us. There's a whole lot more to talk about, and we'll pick it up there when we get back. Stay with us.
We're killing our babies before they are born. Stand up and be kind and come and sound the alarm. Aren't you one of God's children, but nothing but the devil's pawn? Whose side are you?
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or cold.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is still your host, Mark Call. We're talking about some of the things that are going on, especially the ones Big Brother doesn't want you to know about. And I guess you could say we're picking it up on the war front again here. This one, the war against you and the right to own your own body, for crying out loud. Via forced vaccinations, piece by Rebecca Terrell at The New American asks, is it time for Big Brother to become your doctor? And I wonder if she means Dr. Mengele. Anti-vaxxer, it begins, an ugly word akin to genocidal Nazi or child-sacrificing Aztec. And if you are so labeled, you're obviously guilty as charged, prepared to slaughter children. Well, unless, of course, you're a Democrat running for high office, in which case, after they come out of the womb, that's just fine. But this is different. So, other types, anyway. Slaughter children and endanger society for a silly, outdated idea like personal liberty, in defiance of what they define as established science and basic, but not really, human rights. Obviously, human rights aren't what they once meant. Listen to this. New York Times opinion columnist Frank Bruni wrote, quote, this isn't just a public health crisis, it's a public sanity one. Well, so far so good, folks, except he's on the insane side, it would seem, because he continues in the wrong vein. The anti-vaccine crowd aren't trafficking in anything concrete, mundane, and quaint as facts. Full stop. What a lion sack of you-know-what. I guess in this context I'd have to say mercury, thimerosal, and who knows what else is in those things. But the answer is he doesn't want you to. And think about that for just a second more. The very idea that someone would post the contents of what's actually in some of these vaccinations and then be banned for it, this guy has the idiocy to speak out that way about. All right, well, we know the truth. Given that it's obvious he's not stupid, the only other conclusion is that he's downright lying evil. Back to the quote. They're not really engaged in a debate about medicine. They're immersed in a world of conspiracies, in the dark shadows where no data can be trusted. Nothing is what it seems, and those who buy the party line are pitiable sheep. Unquote. And can you actually believe the New York Times would publish unmitigated crap like that? Well, sadly, yes, we can, because we've been watching. And then author Terrell goes on to talk about recent measles outbreaks in the United States having ignited extreme reactions from Big Brother's officials. In January, Washington Governor Jay Inslee declared a public health emergency, citing 31 whole cases in two counties. And one of the facts you're not allowed to talk about, folks, is how many people who catch the measles have been vaccinated against it. Thankfully, given things like indoor toilets and running water, almost nobody ever dies from it anymore anyway. And as the now verboten to even talk about Brady Bunch comedy episode from the early 1970s pointed out, if you have to get sick, measles is sure the way to go. Rockland County, New York, banned unvaccinated children from the public cesspools for 30 days. And, of course, the communist mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, ordered mandatory vaccinations, Achtung, for certain primarily Orthodox Jewish areas of the city, like the community of Williamsburg in Brooklyn, slapping $1,000 fines on anybody who dares to refuse his tyrannical mandate. And when parents, who arguably know a real Nazi when they see one, filed a lawsuit against his edict, de Blasio rebuffed the parents' concerns and bragged, "We will beat them!" And yeah, you can take that two ways. Given de Blasio's predilections, I think both are probably appropriate. But the lies just keep on coming. Implying that victims are dropping like flies, continues the author, and that measles will soon decimate entire cities without extreme protective countermeasures, News outlets fail to mention that most cases are not severe, and that's an understatement. On the contrary, media opportunists feed the flames. The Bloomberg editorial board hopes that these outbreaks may, quote, finally be scaring sense into parents who believe that what they call the myths about vaccines, like they may cause seizures, autism, mercury poisoning, or death. And in a fit of what she rightfully calls yellow journalism at its finest, a CBS affiliate in Texas even featured an alarming picture of a baby supposedly suffering from measles, when in fact the child was injured by the measles vaccine. CBS, quote, decided to use my kid as the poster child for the measles outbreak, writes mom Dawn Newfield on her Facebook page. Oops, I'm sure she's now on the short list to ban. But the irony is that Will doesn't have the measles in this picture. This is the reaction he had to taking the so-called safe MMR shot, unquote. Nevertheless, the witch hunt is on. Writing for Fatherly magazine, Patrick Coleman calls for the arrest of, quote, anti-vaxxers spreading measles, claiming that there are laws und precedent to prosecute. And he points out that federal law allows forced quarantines of those with certain communicable diseases. Full stop. Whoa. Irony time out. Unless, of course, they're illegally crossing the southern border, in which case idiots like this will buy them bus tickets. Anyway, he points out that 9 states allow fines and criminal persecution for spreading infectious disease. Again, with that obvious exception. Certain European countries are already fining parents for refusing to have their children immunized. Are we starting to get sick of all this, folks? The lion really seems to know no bounds. And in true Mein Kampf style, they try to pin the blame on those they're lying to for having to do it. Most of the bulk of the piece we've already talked about here for a long, long time. From bogus statistics, things like herd immunity, and if they're really that safe and effective, you've had them, what are you worried about anyway? To side effects, to the CDC, and their occasional scientific fraud, to Big Brother provided manufacturer immunity and all that goes with it. But the bottom line is interesting. What's behind this governmental fanatic obsession? Is it really about follow the money? Or is it simply that Big Brother truly does want to own your body and everything that goes with it? Well, folks, when it comes to power, your host, as you probably know, tends to lean towards the latter. Although, if they have that, they can get all the money they need or print it besides. But the one thing we know for absolute certain here is that there are plenty of conflicts of interest, and thus lots and lots of reasons to lie. They keep getting bigger and bigger, and no doubt both Uncle Adolf and his buddy Dr. Joe would be proud. So I guess after all of that, it's time for a good news break, albeit briefly. And still having to do with the overthrow of the Republic theme, even some of the jihadist left is starting to wake up to just how far gone things seem to already be, especially as some of the old left begins to distance themselves from the increasingly unrestrained nutcases. So 2 stories. The first one, courtesy of Breitbart, quotes Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, who has come out and warned that so-called representatives like Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan are normalizing, his word, Islamism in American politics and culture. He offered his remarks in a Tuesday interview on SiriusXM's Breitbart News Daily with host Alex Marlowe, where he was offered to comment on a Friday report of a video depicting Muslim children wearing Palestinian attire and singing jihadist songs. It was shared by the Muslim American Society Islamic Center in Philadelphia on their 2 Facebook page. Notice they may be advocating violence, but they're not banned. Said Jasser, quote, people see these clips and they think it's just an aberration or a one-off. Even the bizarre Philadelphia Inquirer, he continued, had the temerity to have a reporter report after this was going viral that the heads of the school said this was just an oversight and it wasn't properly vetted. The only thing he said that wasn't properly vetted was that some parent posted that. Jasser continued, the bottom line is that the Muslim American Society has 35 chapters, and among those chapters they run a number of charter and private schools. It is, according to the Chicago Tribune, and he pointed out this is no vast right-wing conspiracy, the Chicago Tribune had a large 3-part series all the way back in 2004 with an undercover Muslim reporter in one of their schools in Chicago, showing that they are clearly the mirror image, or they are, literally, the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, unquote. And he goes on to provide more and more detail, including a school in Minnesota, not too far from Ilhan Omar's district, that was shut down a few years back, because they were using tax money to force kids into prayer and doing fundamentalist Salafi jihadi-type ideology, which he also said was a bit under the national radar. That school's now been shut down, but a lot of their leaders have reopened institutions under other names in the area, which he said shows you that this is, quote, an endemic deep problem. And here's the bottom line, folks, and it is refreshing to see somebody come out from within, at least an Islamic community, and say exactly what the problem is. Democrats and the broader left, said Jasser, politically exploit Muslims with narratives of victimization, and these left-wing analytical frameworks prevent leftists from accurately addressing problems, cultural, political, social, religious, or otherwise, within Muslim communities and groups. Quote, we're missing the story because nobody wants to connect non-violent Islamism to violent Islamism, said Jasser. This video got people's attention because you had kids talking about chopping off heads. But all the other things in that video about the supremacy of Islamic rule, the antagonism against the Jews, and other things, that's ignored because it's perceived as non-violent, but it is the gateway drug into radical Islamism. And he went on to say these ideas and movements, I believe, are increasing. They're actually getting much more brazen, he said, as folks like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are normalizing their relationships with Hezbollah supporters, with Hamas supporters, and others. This seems to now have open access into various congressional offices. I think the amount of it hasn't changed much, but it's becoming much more prime time, if you will, because they feel unchecked. They're basically given sort of the reign of the left, and the most radical in Congress seem to be leading the left's platform. And then he summarized it this way. Our community has a deep radicalization problem. It has a theocracy problem. And he went on to reject left-wing identity politics as, quote, un-American, and contrary to the very ethos of E Pluribus Unum. Quote, as our founding fathers fought for freedom, religious freedom, liberty against theocracy, the American dream is a positive ethos. We can only defeat our enemies if we know what we're for. The left, all their presidential candidates from Antifa to Move On, they really don't know what they're for other than confiscating our money through taxes and socialism and also confiscating our other rights. At the end of the day, added Dr. Zudi Jasser, this is the reason I'm a conservative. Our movement understands what we're for. We know we're for less government interference, we're for national security, we're for equality and freedom for all, and we're for religious freedom. Wow. And on that good news scale, even some of the left in Hollywood can almost recognize extreme censorship Nazi style when they see it. From J.D. Hayes at Natural News, while you might think that A-list actors, either in Hollywood or New York, who make their living entertaining Americans, should be more sensitive to overt censorship, some claim to remember McCarthyism. The fact that so many of them are to the left of Karl Marx means too many have no problems if the right people are the ones getting censored. Oftentimes they call for more and more people to be banned, censored from the public square, especially on socialist media, simply because they disagree with their political, cultural, or non-socialist views, or especially religious views and opinions. But actor Rob Schneider seems to be an exception to the far-left Hollywood types insofar as his concerns that he calls them progressive Democrats and their like-minded allies in big tech are actually going too far when it comes to pushing for more Orwellian censorship. Snyder, it says, launched a half dozen tweets over the weekend in which he criticized the various socialist tech giants for ramping up their censorship program against what they call far-right figures. And to that end, as many have reported by now, Facebook has deplatformed and even depersoned not only Alex Jones and his InfoWars news sites, but former editor-at-large Paul Joseph Watson, conservative activist Laura Loomer, and a whole bunch of others. By the way, they did put Louis Farrakhan on the list for plausible deniability, and those of us who actually believe in free speech would point out he has no business being censored either, of course. Schneider began by retweeting a post from investigative reporter Cheryl Atkinson warning about the never-ending campaigns by the socialist giants, to Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and others, to ban mostly conservative voices. And when she asked, did this become okay?
And she signed it hashtag slippery slope, inspiring Rob Schneider to tweet, quote, we are in a real world Orwellian nightmare of censorship. Be careful who you label and smear today. You will be smeared tomorrow. And he followed that up with his own thoughts on the subject, noting that the sudden atmosphere of blatant censorship by left-wing so-called progressive Democrats and their supporters is getting downright, and his word is, bizarre. Just bizarre, he said. Progressive Democrats who once stood for civil rights, liberty, free speech, now stand for censorship
and removal of parental rights. Basically, he concluded a sequence, we're not protecting our own First Amendment.
Hashtag eternal vigilance. So yeah, folks, there are at least a few on the left that are starting to recognize a slippery slope now that we're almost in free fall. Which, I guess, takes me next to other insurrection news, like this piece from Joe Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, while they're still on the web, unequivocally and absolutely without a doubt, it begins, Obama knew about the spying and was in on it. We don't know how much spying and attempts of entrapment went on. What we do know is already enough that it would have constituted grounds for actual impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors, and basically demonstrating that everything he's done made Tricky Dick Nixon's enemies list look like a dinner invitation by comparison. And we know that Obama was in on it based on a number of pieces of information. For starters, Obama spied on numerous people for years while he was president. He took the U.S. intelligence community and corrupted it, using the U.S. intelligence apparatus to spy on anyone and everyone, and especially his enemies. We put a list of the many individuals and entities, notes Hoft, Obama spied on in a link. We also know that Hitler's long-lost emails were found in the White House. That was reported by Judicial Watch back in April of this year, announcing that Bill Priestap, former assistant director of the FBI's so-called counterintelligence division, admitted in writing and under oath that the FBI did find Hitler's emails in the Obama White House, specifically the executive office of the president, and they admitted also that about 49,000 of the treason-inspiring things were reviewed as a result of a search warrant for emails found on none other than Anthony Weiner's laptop, which is still hidden somewhere, if it exists at all. We also note, Hoff continues, that Susan Rice, Obama's former national security advisor, sick, left an email on the last day she and Obama were in office confirming he was in on it. Senators Grassley and Graham sent her a letter asking about it, to which she replied, President Obama began the conversation by stressing his continued commitment to ensuring that every aspect of this issue is handled by the intelligence and law enforcement communities by the book. The president stressed that he's not asking about initiating or instructing anything from a law enforcement perspective. He just reiterated that our law enforcement team needs to proceed as normally it would by the book.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, good grief. And they evidently felt guilty about their increasing and now exposed crimes because they sent this email, says Hoft, in an attempt to cover up their patently illegal actions. But, well, unfortunately for them anyway, nobody except the WAPO and CNN are buying it. We also know, he continues, that by advising President-elect Donald Trump in the Oval Office not to hire General Michael Flynn, he was inadvertently admitting he was involved in the coup. And it arguably had to do with the reasons Flynn was fired by the Obama regime as head of the military's intelligence branch. And who could forget this admission by Mr. Perjury and Treason, James Clapper, in March of 2019 to CNN's Anderson Cooper, who said, quote, one point I'd like to make, Anderson, I don't think it's come up very much before. No, I don't think it did either. And I'm alluding to now is Trump's criticism of President Obama for all that he did or didn't do before he left office with respect to the Russian meddling. Here's the money part of the quote, folks. If it weren't for President Obama, we might not have done the intelligence community assessment that we did that set off the whole sequence of events, which are still unfolding today, notably Special Counsel Mueller's investigation. And yeah, the word sick certainly applies there, doesn't it? Spell it how you want. President Obama is responsible for that, said Clapper, and it was he who tasked us to do that intelligence community assessment in the first place. Well, if that's not an admission, folks, in hindsight anyway, you do have to wonder. Of course, he may have just been sending another CYA-style warning. And the Gateway Pundit concludes with a few observations from former U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova, who was on the radio Monday and said that Obama knew about it all. Quote, of course he knew. The Mueller report, he added, was, get this, folks, adolescent, first-year law school crap, a disgrace to his entire career. And if anybody else had done this, what Mueller did, he said, he'd be fired. We'll get into more detail on that in just a minute. Moving on to Comey, he noted that that man was the most criminally corrupt FBI head in history, and when it got to Papadopoulos, he referred to spy slut, that's an insider term evidently, as is honeypot, of course, and probably a CIA spy slut at that, Azra Turk. And her real mission wasn't to obtain evidence, it was to plant evidence for the upcoming unintended FISA warrant. Concludes this piece, Obama was in on it, it was a sham, as was the Mueller investigation, and Obama clearly spied and ordered the spying on the opposition party. And guess what, folks? For reasons that almost certainly included a whole lot of other stuff, only some of which we're starting to hear about, that they intended to cover up and would have gotten away with if they'd been able to get away with the election rigging or the subsequent coup as planned. Or, perhaps even more frighteningly, if President Trump hadn't been smart enough to not rely solely on Secret Service protection to keep him alive. On next to just some of what Joe DiGenova probably meant when he referred to the Mueller report as, among other things, adolescent first-year law school crap. In this case, via a summary from Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, starting with the Federalist Margot Cleveland, a former law clerk of nearly 25 years' experience and instructor at the College of Business, University of Notre Dame, who said the Mueller report fails to consider whether or not the dossier authored by former MI6 spy Christopher Steele was Russian disinformation. And Steele, furthermore, was not charged with lying to the FBI. To not consider that obvious fact is, well, incompetent at best. As Cleveland puts it, given Mueller's conclusion that no one connected to the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to interfere with the election, one of these two scenarios must be true. Either Russia fed Steele disinformation, or Steele lied to the FBI about his Russian sources. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley raised the issue with Attorney General William Barr last week when he asked, my question, Robert Mueller spent over 2 years and $30 million investigating Russia interference in the election. In order for a full accounting of Russia interference attempts, shouldn't the special counsel have considered whether the Steele dossier was part of a Russian disinformation and interfere campaign? To which Barr replied, basically, it was time to look into that and see. The point here, folks, is that the real issue with Mueller's witch hunt report is what Arthur Conan Doyle referred to as the dog that didn't bark. From a famous Sherlock Holmes story, things that should have been considered, but about which silence speaks volumes. Like real Russian meddling, and connections to a campaign that in hindsight it was clear he was covering up for. Like a dog who wouldn't bite the hand that feeds him, much less bark and rat him out. Mueller's second major oversight, sick, is the special counsel's portrayal of Maltese professor Joseph Mifsud as a Russian agent, when available evidence suggests that just maybe, he was a Western agent instead. Here's the key point. Weeks after returning from Moscow, the self-described Clinton Foundation member Mifsud seeded the rumor that Russia had dirt on Hillary Clinton with the honeypotted and much maligned Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos, April 26th of 2016. And as Devin Nunes of California noted on Fox News Sunday, how is it we spend $30-plus million on this as taxpayers, and they can't even tell us who Joseph Mifsud is? Furthermore, he notes this is important because in the Mueller dossier, they use a fake news story to describe Mifsud, and in one of those stories, they even cherry-pick it. Nunes went on to note, look, I don't think the American people expect 20 DOJ lawyers and 40 admittedly tainted, your host notes, FBI agents to write a 450-page report that's built of news stories that in many cases they themselves generated. And what I have a problem with, he continued, is this. When the stories they pick from are their own even, then they cherry pick from them besides. And I think it's becoming more and more clear why U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova used terms like adolescent and crap to describe it. Dan Bongino was a little bit more blunt. He said when it came to Mifsud, either we have a Russian asset who's infiltrated the highest echelons of friendly intelligence services, or we have a friendly who was setting up George Papadopoulos. Representative Matt Gaetz notes one more anomaly.
wondering why Robert Mueller never inquired about Peter Strzok and Lisa Page's so-called insurance policy when he finally got around to firing the guy after he was outed. When Mueller testifies in front of the House Judiciary Committee, says Gates, I'm going to ask him why he never even asked about what evidence might have been polluted by Strzok and Page. Unquote, and I think the answer's obvious.
Whether enough people wake up and see that in time to save what's left of the rule of law is an open question.